This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So this is a phrase we've often heard, but when we say that Massachusetts has a thriving innovation economy, what exactly do we mean?
Well, how about this? The state is fertile ground for high-tech, biotech, and other creative industries.
Which should mean that startups should be able to pop up and grow pretty easily by getting not only the funding that they need, but the human capital they need, too.
In other words, in an innovation economy, employees should be able to move around from job to job with some fluidity.
But that is exactly where, according to a growing chorus of voices, Massachusetts falls short in comparison to other tech-leaning regions like Silicon Valley.
Because unlike California, Massachusetts strictly enforces so-called non-compete clauses in employment contracts.
So joining us now to explain is Scott Kersner. He's the innovation economy columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
It is always great to have you, I have to say. So first of all, so non-compete agreements are fairly common in certain industries, and basically, correct me if I'm wrong, but they put limitations on future jobs that employees can seek after they leave a certain company. What kind of limitations are they?
Well, you know, it's usually part of that package of forms that you sign your first day at work, that you don't pay attention to. That's all your health insurance and, you know, your 401k, and oh, here's the non-compete agreement. And they typically say that for a year or 18 months or 2 years, you can't work either for a certain list of competitors, but more often they're very general. It's you can't take another job in the video game industry, or you can't take another job in the medical device industry.
Sometimes they're even geographic. Like you can't take a job within 200 miles of the current location.
Yeah, and they apply to everyone from a software developer to a biotech scientist to a hairdresser or gymnastics instructor. They're used in all kinds of industries.
And except there are a few in Massachusetts that don't, that are exempt from non-compete agreements.
Yeah, there are definitely some exceptions. The one thing I was going to say is that often people see it on their first day of work and they don't think about it until they want to leave and go work for another company because they're not happy anymore. Or more importantly, they have an idea, a great idea for a new startup that happens to be in the same industry, but they realize, oh, geez, I can't go start this new company.
Not immediately, at least. So the agreements have a time limit, right?
Yeah, but sometimes that time limit could be 18 months or 2 years. So are you going to stock up your savings so you can sit at home, and watch TV for 2 years before you can go start your company.
And by the time that those 2 years elapse, that great idea is an old one.
Yeah, it could be totally stale.
Okay.
You were talking about certain industries. You know, it's fascinating that there are a couple industries that lobbied on Beacon Hill or created their own professional rules to say that non-competes don't apply. So broadcasters, for example, don't have to sign non-competes. So if you're a weatherman on Channel 5, you could quit on Friday and go work for Channel 7 on Monday, and no one's going to come suing you.
Doctors as well?
Doctors and nurses and attorneys, interestingly. So attorneys, while they make lots of money going to court to enforce these non-competes, they could leave one law firm on Friday and go to another one on Monday.
Okay, so that's the non-compete clause 101. What do you say is the problem with these clauses? What impact do you see they have on the economy here in Massachusetts?
The impact is that I think they slow the cycle time of innovation. You know, we talked about having to wait a year or two before you can go pursue that great idea. I mean, we live in the 21st century, and great ideas may be stale after 60 days or 90 days. You know, things move so fast that you don't want to be sitting on the sidelines waiting to build that great company or saving up your money so that you can afford to do nothing for a year while your non-compete expires. And states like California make them completely unenforceable. And other states like Washington State make them, sort of put constraints on how they can be used. And I think, you know, the data you see in California is that fast growing companies like Facebook, they tend to hire a lot of their employees from rivals like Google.
Because they're right there. They're highly skilled. They can just move right across and work for the new company with very little sort of ramp up time.
Exactly.
I also wonder overall, I mean, when we talk, as we said in the introduction here, when we have an innovation economy, there is a sense that in order for that economy to thrive, people have to be willing to take risks. And do you feel that having non-compete clauses and enforcing them, as they do here in Massachusetts, is something that dampens risk, dampens the ability or desire to do innovative research?
I look at it as something that is such a quiet force in the economy. First of all, non-compete is sort of a boring term, right? Really, we should call it, you know, it's about worker mobility or worker freedom, that you could go and work wherever you want. But it's this thing that people don't realize that it affects them until they try to go work for another company or try to go start a company. So it's just this really quiet governor on how many new companies get started and how quickly companies can grow. And you look at big companies like an EMC, which is one of the, you know, the biggest users of non-compete, you know, sort of the most frequent litigators around non-compete agreements. And I just think over that company's 30-year history, we should have seen dozens of spinoffs being created by companies, by former employees of EMC. But because they're so well known as a company that will sue you if you leave to go try to compete with them, we just don't have that sort of crop of children of EMC here that we should.
We'll talk a little bit more in a minute about why businesses want to have, why they say they want to have non-compete clauses. And I feel like some of their reasons are pretty good. But let me ask you, there seems to be another, as you say, a quiet outcome to this. And that is that if you can't move from job to job here in Massachusetts, you got to go somewhere else.
Yeah, you know, there's some really good data actually from an MIT researcher who's looked at what happens in states where non-competes are enforceable and finds that you see a talent exodus, that people go somewhere else. You know, obviously you could go from Massachusetts to California and not have to worry about any law sort of squelching your decisions or limiting your decisions about where you're going to go work next year or the year after that. This researcher at MIT looked at Michigan, where they sort of switched their position. They went from no non-competes to yes, non-competes are okay. And that happened kind of in the later part, in the early part of the 20th century. And you just see the effect that it had in terms of keeping people from moving from job to job and creating this exodus of talented inventors leaving Michigan.
Well, listeners, we are talking about non-compete agreements and the impact and the pushback that they have, or the pushback against them that's starting to emerge a little bit in Massachusetts, and whether or not such non-compete clauses in employment contracts, whether they protect individual businesses or they cost the state's overall economy. So a couple questions for you, listeners. I mean, do you think it's time for Massachusetts, as California has, to ban non-compete clauses? And do you have one in your contract? And what effect has it had on your ability to find a new job? And for employers who are listening, do you feel that non-competes are the only thing that protects your most valuable asset, which is the knowledge, the trade secrets, and the information, say, in the heads of your employees? And overall, if the state is going to have a vibrant economy, a vibrant one as possible, can we do so with or without non-competes? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let me introduce another voice into the conversation, Scott, if I can. His name is Andrew Boddy, and he is a director at the law firm of McLean, Graff, Rawlinson. And Middleton. He's a former chairman of the Smaller Business Association of New England and a specialist in non-competition agreements. Andrew Boddy, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So let me ask you, you heard what Scott Kersner's had to say about why he thinks that non-compete agreements stifle the economy.
Right.
What do you see as the most compelling reasons for businesses to enforce them?
Well, first, let me just give a little background. We have cases going back to as early as 1813 that have upheld restrictive covenants as not being contrary to public policy by restraining trade. That's in Massachusetts. Now, certainly no one could argue seriously that the economy hasn't grown substantially since 1813 in Massachusetts. And by way of demographics, you know, the EMCs of the world, even though they're great companies, they're really the exception, not the norm. The stats are that 86% of the companies in Massachusetts have 19 or fewer employees. So they tend to be smaller businesses. And the smaller companies, what smaller business owners will tell you, what they've told me over the years is, why should I come to Massachusetts and start a company, mortgage all my assets, you know, sign away my my finances, et cetera, to a bank, and start a company if one of my employees can simply take my ideas and my products and go across the street and start a competing business and I can't do anything about it? So the concern is that, smaller companies in particular need a strong legal backing so that they can protect their intellectual property. They tend to do things a little informally, not like the EMCs of the world.
Right. And that, and that, and what I'm hearing is that the cost of losing basically the knowledge that those few number of employees have is greater for smaller companies than it would be for a larger one.
That's right. And there actually have been a few studies that have looked at this. There's one out of the Texas A&M and the University of Richmond that concluded that, you know, California's legal environment where they don't enforce non-competes actually hinders startups in the biotech industry for that very reason, which is, you know, the companies are afraid that they're going to lose their IP, their products, to someone who's unscrupulous, who's just going to take it, as they say, go across the street and start a competing business.
Well, what about the fact that for every company that enforces its non-compete agreements, that's also a its neighbor here in Massachusetts is going to do the same thing. So therefore, they can't profit from trying to get an employee from the firm across the street. It's kind of what goes around comes around, essentially.
Yeah, there's no question that that dynamic does happen. But what I would say, you know, there have been arguments made on the side of doing away with non-competes that somehow it stifles employment. And I say, look at the unemployment figures for Silicon Valley for the last couple of years. They've been in double digits, much worse than Massachusetts, much worse than North Carolina, the Research Triangle, where they enforce non-competes, much worse than Texas, where they also will enforce non-competes. So there's a disconnect there. I don't believe that enforcing non-competes translates directly into stifling employment or hurting employment. And I can say as a practitioner in 20 years, most of the time what happens is we work something out. Okay, we negotiate. The person's not out of a job. And in fact, there was a high-profile case with EMC recently where someone ran off to California thinking they could avoid their non-compete that they had signed with the company in Massachusetts. And actually, they worked out something where that person could work but couldn't have the competing job with the new employer for the length of time that was in the non-compete agreement.
And so oftentimes these cases stay out of court. I take your point on that, but let me get Scott Kersner back in here. Scott, what do you make of this argument that, especially for small companies, the greatest asset is the employee, him or herself, and that employee basically has proprietary knowledge in their head? Why not protect it?
You know, I've lived in California. I noticed that there are a lot of small companies out there, too, that didn't go extinct because people can walk out the door and go work somewhere else if they choose to take their talents there. I think that one of the examples I like to use is if someone just graduates from Tufts with a PhD, you know, and they go to work for a company for a year and they decide they don't like it or they have the great idea for their next startup, who's invested more in that person's skills and knowledge and talent? The employer who paid them for, a year, 18 months, or they who've spent, you know, money on, you know, 6, 8, 10 years of pursuing that PhD? I just think this whole argument about trying to protect a company's products or patents or trade secrets by locking people down and forcing them to stay in a job and not leave it, is really fallacious, that there are lots of ways to protect a company's a livelihood in business without forcing people to stay in a job that they may want to leave.
But let me ask you, I mean, this is exactly the line of argument that it seems the Massachusetts courts have agreed with. I mean, I was reading about a case that was in U.S. District Court just this year, Aspect Software versus Gary Barnett. And Mr. Barnett was a high-level executive at Aspect Software. He went to go work for a rival company. Aspect decided it was going to enforce its non-compete. And the court decided that given Mr. Barnett's access to Aspect's competitive information and basically the similarity of what he was doing with the new company versus what he was doing before, the interesting part is that the court decided it was hard to conceive of how Mr. Barnett could set aside the information in his memory as he worked for a new employer. I mean, that seems to be like kind of a fact of the way information is transferred these days. We are the conduits of the transfer.
So does that mean that whenever you take a job, you can't, you can only stay with that company? You can't go take your talents to somewhere else in the industry? I mean, it's always silly to me when you hear lawyers talking about non-competes, because Mr. Boddy, if he wanted to leave the firm he works for today and go work for somewhere else, you know, go start his own firm tomorrow and create 10, 20, 30, who knows how many jobs, he could do it. And how is it the legal profession can survive if attorneys can go take their skills to whatever firm they want?
Andrew Boddy, let me get you to respond to that. And also this notion that there are other ways to protect, intellectual and intangible properties that companies work so hard to develop. Go ahead.
I'll take up the second issue first, which is, you know, there are other avenues such as non-solicitation agreements. The problem there, though, is once you ring a bell, you can't unring it. And it's just like what you said about Aspect Software, that particular case. There's an implicit understanding with a non-compete agreement that that person is going to transfer information from their mind, even inadvertently, to a competitor which should not belong, which does not belong into the competitor's hands. And, you know, you can't stop that from happening by having a non-solicitation agreement. And the other problem with that is, you know, there's a limited amount of time that companies have when they're developing a product. And what the law says is basically that for that period of time, that product development period of time, you know, there should be an avenue where the company can protect the product development period and not have to worry about some kind of either explicit or implicit transfer of information to a competitor.
But what about that general notion that Scott has returned to a couple times, that there are, you know, other places in this country that don't have non-competes and businesses are surviving
there? Other places in the world. I mean, it's so micro to say, look, we want to prevent there from being competitors to Acme Company in Massachusetts, when the reality is those competitors are going to pop up in California and they're going to pop up in Beijing and Bangalore and all these other places where Massachusetts law has, you know, has no traction at all.
Well, I mean, you know, it all sounds reasonable, but I don't think it's really reflects reality, because there are only two or three states in the country that don't enforce non-compete agreements. I don't see that we're the only state that, you know, is having some kind of economic problem because we do enforce them. So, you know, the economy of the United States has grown exponentially since World War II, with non-competes being enforced pretty much nationwide all over the place. So there's a disconnect in that argument. I mean, companies can spring up and they can compete on a legitimate basis. What we're talking about is unfair competition, where somebody spends a lot of money developing a product. They have some key people involved. One or two of those people become disenchanted, and they want to take that information and go start a competing business, and therefore cut out all of the development time, effort, and money that's been spent by the former employer, and just go ahead and do it. That, I don't think that seems right.
Andrew Boddy, if you hold on for just a second, and Scott Kirzner, stand by as well. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. A lot of people have things to say about non-compete agreements in Massachusetts and whether or not we should keep them, or as they've done in places like California, ban them altogether. Let's go to Frank, who's calling from Northborough. You're on the air, Frank.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I own a mid-size IT firm here in Northborough, Massachusetts, and I agree with Attorney Boddy that I think you need to have non-compete agreements with your employees. We, as small business owners, you know, we leverage our house, we sign on our notes, you know, we take out our bank loans, and we meet our payroll every week, and there's nothing to stop an engineer who has 4 or 5 of your major accounts, if we didn't have a non-compete, you know, to go out and open up, a competitive IT firm just down the street, and, you know, you're out hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
Frank, thank you so much for your call. I want to get another view in here from Newton. Kevin is on the line.
Hi, thanks a lot for taking my call. I guess my primary concern is that currently is that graduating college students, especially students in the technology disciplines, will leave the state and probably actually should leave the state. My son's a college student studying technology in Massachusetts, and he got a summer job in technology last summer, and, you know, summer job typically would be, a number of weeks, 3 months, and was actually asked to sign a one-year non-compete, or required to sign a one-year non-compete for that job. So I'm not really sure what to tell him when he graduates, and I think it might be wise to advise him to move out of state.
Wow. So you'd say Massachusetts isn't the place for him. Kevin, thank you so much for your call. I want to get in another one here if I can. Sam is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Sam.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Last year when this whole thing came up with Representative Brownsberger's bill, I was one of the people who testified in favor of non-compete. I think there's points to both what Scott says and your attorney says that are true, but I think both of them are proposing a rather extreme point of view You don't need a non-compete to protect IP. Intellectual property is prevented, is protected anyway. On the other hand, you do need a non-compete if it's going to take you a certain number of years in order to exploit your invention to the fullest.
Mm.
If I have an invention, and Scott makes the point that the lifetime of an idea is 60 days or 90 days, there is a class of industries where that is absolutely true. There's also a class of industries where an idea may take 3 years or 4 years before you can bring it to fruition. And it is in those industries that you want protection to make sure that the investment you've made is not going to be taken over by somebody who says, that's a brilliant idea. I'm going to figure out a different way of doing this thing.
Sam, if I can take your thought here and run with it a little bit, thank you so much for your call, because I feel like what Sam's pointing to is that maybe there's some middle ground here. I mean, there's obviously a lot of disagreement, not only in amongst employees, but employers as well, as to what's the best way for Massachusetts as a state to move forward. I mean, we received a statement from a company who's based in Boston here called Bullhorn, and the spokesman for Bullhorn said, in Massachusetts, non-compete agreements are the rule, not the exception. And since Massachusetts-based competitors use them, we need to as well. Non-competes are what protect or embargo companies' trade secrets. And then it goes on, the statement goes on to say something interesting. That they add, however, if the state abandoned non-competes for all companies, it would level the competitive playing field. And while it's not a perfect analogy, consider the debate about the statewide smoking ban in Massachusetts. It's not going to work until every business has to do it, and then it levels the playing field. So, Scott Kirzner, I mean, do you see this as something where the state actually would have to make an intervention here?
It's totally like nuclear disarmament, where no one wants to do it unilaterally. I ran into a CEO this morning in Cambridge who, you know, startup company, but about 200 to 300 employees, you know, has raised $50, $60 million in venture capital. And he basically said, competitively, I need to get people to sign non-compete agreements because everyone else asks them to sign non-compete agreements. But if you ask me what would be good for the Boston tech economy, what would be good for the Massachusetts economy, if we all got rid of them and you had this free flow of talent and ideas and entrepreneurship, yes, that'd be much better for the economy as a whole.
Andrew Boddy, do you see that there's a tension here between what individual businesses might think is good for them versus what's good for the economic ecosystem that they're living in? And I just want to throw in one more question because, yeah, you know, we have a lot of young listeners out there who are in college or who just graduated from college, and they're growing up in a generation where they're told in advance, you're going to have a lot of jobs in your lifetime. Don't non-competes make it kind of difficult for that to be a reality, for this new, you know, sort of high turnover economy to come to full fruition here in Massachusetts?
Well, the idea behind a non-compete is not that someone can't work. It's just that they have to be working in an industry that's not directly competitive with their former employer's industry for a limited amount of time and in a limited geographical setting. And I can tell you that the courts are very careful about how they enforce these things. In fact, most of the time when you go into court on something like this, you're facing an uphill battle because the judges are well aware that, you know, they may be making an order that keeps somebody from working. So it's not that simple to just go in and say, okay, here I am, Your Honor, enforce this agreement. I mean, you have to dot all your I's, cross all your T's. And as I said, most of the time, someone is going to be negotiating to be able to work, maybe not exactly in that same job, but still stay employed. And as I said, the unemployment figures for Silicon Valley versus the rest of the country, in particular Massachusetts, North Carolina, Texas, do not support this notion that somehow enforcing these agreements keeps people out of work and hurts employment.
Well, we do have some legislation that is pending on Beacon Hill, so this is an issue that's under consideration at the state level. We'll leave it at that today. Andrew Boddy, director of the law firm of McLean, Graff, Rollerson & Middleton, and former chairman of the Smaller Business Association of New England, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Scott Kirzner, innovation economy columnist for the Boston Globe. You always get us thinking. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Meghna.
And listeners, definitely let us know what you think online at radioboston.org. Coming up in just a moment, Chris Herron, basketball junkie. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.